Deutsche Welle, Spotlight on Europe.
A very warm welcome to this edition of Spotlight on Europe. My name is Wanjiko Mwaura, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. If you're joining us for the first time, this show is on Europe from an African perspective. Right, let's get started. Coming up in the next half hour, 2017 looks like the year of elections as Britain decides to go to the polls this June. But are the politicians risking election fatigue?
You're joking. Not another one? I can't stand this. There's too much politics going on at the moment. Why does she need to do it? I think the whole country has had enough.
Meanwhile, in Turkey, divisions continue following a referendum to extend President Erdogan's power. And Italy inaugurates its first Muslim think tank. Do stick around for these stories and more in this edition of Spotlight on Europe. The EU's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, says China and Europe have a common responsibility to avoid a military escalation on the Korean Peninsula. Mogherini was on a three-day trip to Beijing, where she discussed the issue of North Korea at length during the talks with Chinese officials. Helen Sini has the details and this roundup of European news.
EU policy chief Federica Mogherini said a crisis with North Korea would have a global fallout. Europe and China, she added, needed to push Pyongyang to abide by its international obligations, re-engage with the international community, and work together for a denuclearized Korean Peninsula. North Korea's acceleration of its nuclear weapons program, to the point where it may become capable of striking the US, is seen as pushing the peninsula towards its most severe crisis in years. Mogherini also called for more engagement from China on global and security issues. Germany's right-wing populist party, the Alternative for Germany, or AfD, is scrambling to sort out its candidates list ahead of federal elections in September. It's been dealt a blow by the shock announcement that its best-known politician, Frauke Petri, won't be standing as a candidate, and that will undoubtedly impact the party's prospects in the polls. The AfD was formed as a Eurosceptic party in the wake of the Euro debt crisis, and it's become an anti-foreigner and anti-Islam party since Petri was elected party chief in 2015. Her decision seems to have caught other party members off guard and came just days before a party meeting where the AfD was expected to nail down its party list for the upcoming elections. The AfD has been split by bickering between its leading figures. There's speculation that Petri has been facing a threat to her leadership, but she's also pregnant, which may have influenced her decision. Russia's FSB State Security Service has detained the brother of the man suspected of orchestrating the suicide bomb attack on the St. Petersburg metro earlier this month. He's the 10th person to have been detained. 14 people died in the attack and more than 50 were injured. The FSB said Akram Azimov had helped transfer money and communicated with unspecified terrorist groups in preparation for the attack. His brother Abror told a Russian court earlier this week that he was an unwitting accomplice in the bombing. The two brothers are naturalized Russian citizens from Kyrgyzstan. The Italian Health Ministry says the country is suffering a measles epidemic following a fall-off in vaccinations. The number of cases there has tripled this year, largely because parents are not having their children vaccinated because of fears of a link between the combined measles, mumps and rubella shot and autism. Several major studies, however, have shown no evidence of such a link. According to Italy's Higher Health Institute, only around 85% of two-year-olds are currently being vaccinated against measles. That's well below the 95% threshold recommended by the World Health Organization to block the illness. The WHO warned last month that measles has become more prevalent in many countries across Europe. A And finally, the UN War Crimes Commission has finally released files that show the Allies knew much more about the Holocaust during World War II than previously thought. The documents have now been made publicly accessible after Cold War politics kept them locked away for decades. The Vienna Library in London made 900 gigabytes of data available this week, copied from the original documents kept at UN headquarters in New York. The files document how war crimes were handled by the Allies between 1943 and 1949 and make clear that Allied forces knew more about the details of the Nazi concentration camp system before the end of the war than has generally been thought. This is partly due to files collected by the exiled governments of Belgium, Poland and Czechoslovakia, which spent a lot of time collecting hundreds of pages of detailed evidence of war crimes to indict specific leading Nazis, including Adolf Hitler himself.
That was Helen Sini with a roundup of European news. That was Yemi Alade welcoming us back to Spotlight on Europe. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura. As if there weren't enough elections in Europe this year, Britain has also thrown its hat into the ring. Prime Minister Theresa May this week called a snap election for June 8th. This is barely 2 years into a five-year parliamentary term. Experts say she's wooing support for Britain, leaving the EU by seizing on the current weakness of the main opposition Labour Party. By holding an early election, she'll avoid going to the polls in 2020. At this time, Britain's negotiations with Brussels over the terms of Brexit may well have stalled. Nick Martin has more on the week's events in London.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election to be held on the 8th of June.
While Britain's media was whipped up into a frenzy over Prime Minister Theresa May's sudden election announcement, this comment from someone called Brenda has been doing the rounds on social media and maybe sums up the public's reaction.
You're joking. Not another one? I can't stand this. There's too much politics going on at the moment. Why does she need to do it? I think the whole country has had enough.
Having narrowly won the 2015 general election, and then after calling the electorate out for a referendum last year on the country's EU membership, the centre-right Conservatives are hoping to secure a landslide in the third national poll in as many years. With her party leading its main opposition Labour by 21 points in the latest opinion polls, an early vote is the perfect opportunity to boost Mrs May's parliamentary majority. She insisted the snap election was necessary to ensure a strong negotiating hand with Brussels after the country voted last year to leave the EU.
At this moment of enormous national significance, there should be unity here in Westminster. But instead, there is division. The country is coming together, but Westminster is not. Our opponents believe, because the government's majority is so small, that our resolve will weaken and that they can force us to change course. They are wrong. They underestimate our determination to get the job done.
While Mrs May claims to have healed the schism that last year's Brexit vote caused, political scientist Tim Bale says deep divisions remain, which are likely to lead to low voter turnout for the June 8th election.
It's clear, if you look at opinion polls, that most people still hold to the opinion that they had at the time of the EU referendum. If they voted to leave, then they still think we should leave. If they voted to remain, then many people still think they should remain. The country is still roughly split down the middle with a little bit of a bias towards leaving. I think it will take a long time to heal that wound.
Although the British economy has outperformed expectations since the Brexit vote, there are signs that business and consumer confidence is now falling. The national currency, the pound, has dropped sharply, and the prolonged uncertainty is leading many companies to put off investment. Labour's shadow finance minister, John McDonnell, accused Mrs May of having no choice but to go back on her word.
I think people will be angry that she's promised, well, at least on seven occasions now, that she would not bring an early general election. She said that she'd have an election in 2020. So I think people will be pretty angry, and it looks as though it's putting party before the country. But I also think she realises people are waking up to the fact that the economy now is beginning to dive. You've seen inflation increasing, you've seen wages stagnating. In addition to that, she realises that she cannot deliver on the promises she's given over Brexit. She can't even hold her own party together on it. So I think she's cutting and running.
In Scotland, the poll will once again be dominated by talk of the country seeking independence from the UK. In their own referendum 3 years ago, Scottish voters narrowly rejected complete self-rule, but last year overwhelmingly voted to remain in the EU. That determination to maintain strong links with Brussels has reignited the independence debate. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, warned that Mrs May had made a huge miscalculation by calling an early election.
She clearly seized the opportunity, given the total disarray in Labour, to crush all opposition, to get rid of people who disagree with her, and to get a free hand to take the UK in an ever rightward direction. And that would mean not just the hardest possible Brexit, but more austerity and deeper cuts. So in Scotland, this is the time to make sure that we stand up for Scotland's interests, make Scotland's voice heard, and ensure that we have MPs fighting Scotland's corner.
With the ruling Conservatives seen as boosting their parliamentary majority next month, Mrs May well be handed the political unity she says she needs for the upcoming negotiations over Britain's future relations with the EU. Many experts believe the two-year timeframe set out by Article 50 of the EU's Lisbon Treaty will not be long enough to secure a deal. Professor Tim Bale, who lectures in politics at Queen Mary University of London, says the last thing Mrs May wants is to be forced to go to the polls during what could be protracted EU talks.
Had she not, she would have been facing an election in 2020, a year or less after the Brexit negotiations were formally completed, or supposedly formally completed. I think most people think it might take a little bit longer than that, and that there may well be a transition period even following that. So actually pushing out the election to 2022, as she would be able to, or 2021, which seems a little bit more likely, that gives her a little bit more room for manoeuvre, a little bit more time, I think, to get the kind of deal that she wants with Brussels, whatever that is.
Mrs May's plan has been widely praised by Britain's media, but one Brussels-based analyst warned it could backfire. Michelle Van Houten said on Twitter that if Mrs May thinks winning an election strengthens your hand in negotiations with the EU, she better go and talk to Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. Nick Martin, DW, London.
Now, that shock announcement from the UK has set the strategists scrambling in Brussels too. But should the EU get involved this time? Terry Schultz reports.
For those British voters who desperately hoped last year's Brexit outcome was just a bad dream, Britain's newly announced general elections may look like a new dawn, a second chance to have a say on European Union membership. A hashtag, EURef2, referring to a second referendum, lit up the Twitterverse with just that message. In Brussels, Carnegie Europe director Tomáš Valašek admits he was instinctively in the EURef2 camp when May surprised everyone with her decision Tuesday.
As a European, of course, my first thought was, oh my God, a heaven sent, a second chance perhaps to run another referendum de facto, but of course with a different result.
However, Valašek quickly had a second thought.
Then you start thinking about it and you realize, no, this is probably a delusion. The whole notion of European Union actually running a campaign, if there's one thing that proud countries are averse to, it's being told by other countries how to run their business and how they were wrong to vote in a popular referendum.
That was one of the reasons EU leaders tried to keep a low profile on the issue ahead of the Brexit vote. Then Prime Minister David Cameron, who wanted to remain in the bloc, thought it would be counterproductive for Brussels to be seen trying to sway votes. That didn't end up helping pro-Europe campaigners. So why wouldn't Brussels try another tactic this time, with less to lose? Josef Janning, a Berlin-based senior fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations, says there's just not much to win. He insists this is not a second referendum on the EU.
I can understand why many people see it that way, but they couldn't pick a worse fight for this issue than this one, because it is entirely designed to endorse the government position.
Janning argues it's still the right move for Brussels to stay on the sidelines.
I don't really see anyone waving the British flag and wanting to reverse the process. The only force which I see in such an election campaign that would take a view different from the May government would be the Scottish National Party. And they would rather seek to divert the water onto their mills, which is not exactly what other European leaders, Merkel included, would like to endorse, because they don't want to feed separatism in Europe.
Stavros Papagiannis, a former European Commission official, sees the situation differently.
It will be more than a statement on Brexit. It will be definitely a second referendum. Rejection of the May government now in place will be a yes vote to remain in the EU.
Papagiannis, now a communications consultant, urges Brussels to act boldly and immediately launch an information campaign in all 28 member states about the importance of the EU and of the UK staying in it. He believes it would have an impact.
British citizens have now more information. They are better informed. And I think that many British people will vote differently. They understand now the consequences of the referendum. They understand what that means to leave the European Union, that it may cause the independence of Scotland, and that the United Kingdom will be a smaller kingdom.
That's something on which he and the ECFR's Janning agree. Janning says even if she does stay in power, the price will be steep for May. He believes calling the election now was a mistake as big as former Prime Minister Cameron's decision to put Brexit to a referendum in the first place.
I think it will all accelerate the disintegration of the United Kingdom. It will deepen the division. It's like on the Titanic. You know, they continue to dance until the ballroom gets floated. You know, they will continue to talk about global Britain and how significant Britain's role in the world is to the last day of the existence of the United Kingdom.
Green politician Molly Cato Scott is a member of the European Parliament, a strong Remain voter. But she sides with those saying this is not another vote on Brexit. She says Theresa May should have to explain her position on domestic policies in this general election before she receives a renewed mandate, with which she'll also negotiate Britain's way out of the EU. Then, Scott says, those who campaigned to leave must be held to account.
Promises were made. I know, because I work in Brussels, those promises cannot be kept, and many of them have been abandoned already. So basically, people have been sold a lie in Brexit, and if they don't think that the deal is what they voted for, then they should have the right to say they'd rather stay in the European Union.
Scott pledges that she and other like-minded politicians will make sure there is a true EU ref too, but only once exit negotiations with the EU are finished and the consequences of leaving are clear. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Presidents around the world have been wooing citizens for extensions of their powers and office term limits. This has been a hot button issue in countries such as Burundi, DRC, Congo, Rwanda, and Turkey now joins the club. On Wednesday, the Electoral Reform Commission announced that it would not annul the results of Sunday's referendum after the opposition contested. President Erdogan won by a narrow margin the right to change the constitution and extend his powers. Since the weekend, there have been daily protests across the country. So Emma Wallace asked our correspondent in Turkey, Dorian Jones, whether the commission's decision would help to calm troubled waters.
Not at all. In fact, it's probably just made the division a whole lot worse, given the fact that the electoral board only spent a few hours considering it, and one observer said just long enough for them to read it and then to reject it. It does appear that they didn't give any real consideration to this. There's no real surprise about that, given the fact that most of the board have been appointed by the president and the government and have been recently purged following the July coup attempt. So the expectation was that they would reject it. Also, it was their initial controversial decision to allow uncertified ballots, which is at the centre of this controversy. And they've been in the head of the board and made it very clear he wasn't to take back that decision. And we're seeing more protests on the streets. In fact, just following the decision, saw some of the biggest protests in Istanbul and thousands of people taking to streets in many parts of the city. And there are similar protests in the capital, Ankara, and others on a much smaller scale, but also in many provincial cities as well. So at the moment, the people seem to, those opposing the yes vote, are still very mobilized and very motivated.
That's interesting, given that however small a margin they did lose, I was expecting there to be more anger in the country, but you say they're quite positive.
There is anger, for sure, among many that they feel this vote was stolen, but they are not depressed even, and they're not in many ways defeated. They believe that they won this vote. And more than that, everyone was predicting, the president was predicting a massive victory, even though the opinion polls were pointing against that. And there was the expectation that, many felt they would, one way or another, deliver on that big victory, like he did in the November general election in 2015. But it didn't happen that way. And the fact that it was such a narrow vote, many opponents of the president for a long time have been portrayed, particularly most of the government-controlled media, as being a small, irrelevant minority who don't represent the people. Now many no voters believe that they do represent the people, or at least half the country. And most crucially, it was the big cities result, which I think is giving a big boost to the opposition. Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir, the biggest cities in the country, Istanbul and Ankara, normally strongholds for the president, all voted no. And I think that is also giving a major impetus to the opponents of the president who are focusing around this no campaign. So for at least for now, they do feel motivated. And in fact, they are looking forwards to the 2019 general election and presidential election because they really believe that they have a chance of defeating Erdogan.
Last time we spoke, you were talking about Erdogan courting the Kurds in the south of the country. Was he at all successful with that strategy?
Well, that's a big question, in fact. In many ways, much of the attention in analysing this result and the controversy over it is focusing on this predominantly Kurdish region. Because even though they overwhelmingly voted no, the number of votes was significantly less in many areas than the normal support for the main pro-Kurdish HDP party, which is avidly opposed to the referendum. Now, it seems that the government are claiming, and the president are claiming, that those extra votes that they received was enough to give them victory. Now, that's a very, very controversial statement because much of the allegations over vote stuffing is focusing on this Kurdish region because it's under incredibly strict military and security force control because it's a center of a battle against PKK insurgents. Many monitors couldn't get access to ballot stations, including international monitors. In fact, one international monitor was briefly detained by the police. So much of the attention is focusing there because it does appear that there's very unexplained upsurges in votes in yes, in very strongholds of opponents of no. In one case, 100% voted yes, in an area that normally is very anti-president, anti-government. But the story from the government and the president is that they, in many ways, helped us to win. And that is opening the door to possibly a start of a peace process. Because a takeaway from the president was the nationalists didn't deliver the votes to him. Possibly he could be looking forward to again courting the Kurdish vote, which he has in the past secured a large amount of support when he started a peace process, which ultimately failed. Talk is now that there could be another peace process starting.
What will this vote mean for Turkey's foreign policy, do you think, particularly its relations with Europe?
Straight after the victory for the president, he launched an unprecedented, even by his standards, tough attack on Europe and the West in general, saying that he defeated the crusaders of the West, the ideology of the West, and their servants in Turkey, which was a reference to the no voters. Very tough, particularly also now that there are the international monitors from the OSCE and Council of Europe have condemned the way the referendum was held. Very tough criticism. That has further stoked the fires of anti-West, anti-Europe European rhetoric. But where does it go from now is unclear. The president has talked about bringing back the death penalty, holding a referendum on that, as well as on whether Turkey should continue its EU membership talks. But if he is going to shift away from courting the nationalists towards possibly the Kurds, that could herald a different strategy there, because any attempt at a peace process would be welcomed by Europe. And that could even lay the basis for some sort of resetting of relations. So it's all in the balance at the moment. And I think even the president himself hasn't made up his mind on what strategy to take, because the result of the vote, even though he won, was a major shock to him and setback because he didn't win big.
That was Dorian Jones in Turkey speaking to Emma Wallis. This week in Italy, a group of Italian Muslims founded the country's first ever think tank, composed both of religious and non-religious members. The new group, called Isan in Arabic, or Excellence in English, was formed in response to concern about growing Islamophobia in a country that has historically been tolerant. Megan Williams has more from Rome.
At a recent press conference in Rome, members of Italy's new Muslim think tank told of their hopes in fostering tolerance of and more active citizenship by Italy's diverse Muslim community. Then came the kind of question Muslims in Italy say they've come to expect. A journalist asks why they hadn't condemned the recent terror attacks against Christian Copts in Egypt, or talked about interreligious dialogue with Catholics. The group responded that they had condemned terror attacks and pointed out that one of their members is an author of books on interreligious dialogue.
There is a certain psychological search for, if I may say, the monster.
Yaya Pallavicini is one of the 35 founding members of the new Ihsan think tank. With a Japanese mother and an Italian father who converted to Islam in the 50s, he says he's just one member of Ihsan who offers a different perspective on Muslims than the one depicted by the Italian media.
They are victims, they are criminals, but there is a majority of Muslims that who need to learn how to be part of the society, or at least to say that they are part of the society and have nothing to do with these two extremes.
He says the debate on Islam, migrants, and security here has been missing the contribution of Muslims who know the Italian context, and a group that's composed of both religious and non-religious Muslims who can publicly respond to the issues of the day. Iranian immigrant Pariza Nazari, another founding member of Ihsan, works as a pharmacist here in Rome.
I choose to live here in Italy because I find the people very, very open.
Nazari, who could pass for Italian and doesn't wear a veil, says she hasn't experienced discrimination directly.
People say to me, I didn't know that you are not from Italy. And it's not a compliment for me because I know that a lot of other people who don't have the same color of my skin, or women who choose to put a veil, maybe are judged because of their religion.
She says in the past few years, a fear of Muslims has set in that didn't used to be here. Unlike France or Germany, Italy's Muslim population comes from around the world and is relatively new. There have been very few cases of young people becoming radicalized. Nazari is concerned that the rise of anti-Muslim populist parties could put young Muslims at more risk of radicalization as they feel more marginalized. Ali Abraham Ga from Senegal agrees. He's lived here in Italy for some 20 years and says the Ihsan think tank offers a way for integrated Muslims to help marginalized younger ones here claim their full rights as active citizens.
Io ti dico la verità, in Italia non ti senti discrimine l'Islam.
Gas says here in Italy he hasn't felt discrimination as a Muslim, but he has in France, where the anti-immigrant far right has made huge gains. Italian anti-immigrant groups here are relatively small. And he says he doesn't want that sentiment to grow anymore. A reason why both he and Iranian Nazari say they'll focus their work with the think tank on young Italians, both non-Muslim and Muslim, educating them about how everyone has the right to peaceful coexistence.
And it's important for Italians who are not Muslims to know who is your neighbor, who is the people you have to deal with each day.
A main goal of the new Muslim think tank in Italy. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight on Europe. We hope you've enjoyed the show and we would love to hear from you. Do go over to our Facebook page, DW Africa, and leave us your thoughts on today's show. Thanks to the rest of the team, Eliane Giadulci, Helen Zini, Emma Wallace, and our technician, Marvin Stemmer. And thank you for tuning in as well. We'll be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week. Sonola